Good morning. Welcome. Today we're going to hear oral argument in case of Intermountain Power Agency versus Union Pacific Railroad Company, STB docket number 42136. You all look like veterans of these proceedings, so I'm not going to go through. I think you know how these lights work. And my understanding is each side has been allotted 20 minutes per side, and that IPA has decided to take 15 minutes on opening and 5 minutes for rebuttal. So that is correct. So that's how the lights will be handled. So why don't we begin?
Good morning, Chairman Elliott, Vice Chairman Begeman, Commissioner Mulvey. My name is Michael Loftus with the firm Slover and Loftus, appearing on behalf of IPA. I'm accompanied at counsel's table by my partner, Andy Kolasar, and I would like to note for the board's the presence of John Aguilar of the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, which is the fuels purchasing and operating agent for the Intermountain Power Agency. John is also a witness in this proceeding. I'd like to begin by addressing the issues that the board flagged in the decision scheduling this argument, and then we'll address a few other major issues and as time permits. I've provided to the board some oral argument exhibits. They're all from the existing record before the board. And I'd ask you to turn to oral argument exhibit number one. And that is a schematic of the Intermountain Standalone Railroad, the IRR, which has been presented in the evidence by IPA in this case. UP argues that if the board finds that the IRR's revenues exceed the IRR's costs, the board needs to conduct a cross-subsidy analysis under Otter Tail to determine the amount of the prescribed rates. In other words, to see if the prescribed rate should be limited under Otter Tail. Thank you. In Otter Tail, the board uses a schematic that appears at page 10 of that decision, and it describes in connection with that three shippers. Shipper one is the complaining shipper, and the rail facilities required to transport its traffic are identified as the core facilities. Shipper two is a shipper who also uses the core facilities and, in addition, secondary facilities that serve shipper two but not the complaining shipper. Shipper three uses only the secondary facilities and none of the core facilities. The Otter Tail limitation applies only in situations involving shipper three traffic. In this case, there is no shipper three traffic, and as a result, there is no Otter Tail cross limitation concern. Now I'd ask you to turn to oral argument exhibit number two, which is a schematic of the segment near Lindell, and it shows the main line moving down. It's the dotted line residual UP, then solid below that, going down to the center of the page, and it shows the IRR Lindell yard to the right of that. UP claims that the crossover traffic moving between Lindell and Milford on the IRR does not share any facilities with the issue traffic. And it has two strained theories as to why that is so. The first is that the main line and yard tracks are separate and distinct rail facilities. Now, this exhibit, or this schematic presented by UP, is somewhat misleading, I think. When you look at the degree of separation between the main line and the yard tracks. If you look at exhibit number 3, it contains portions of two exhibits submitted in the record. The first, 3B2, from IPA's evidence, and the second is from UP's evidence. I want to go to the very first page of that exhibit, and if you look at the upper left-hand corner where you see milepost 665.
Excuse me. Maybe I'm getting old, but these pages are all numbered the same, 3B2. There is a reference to page 2 of 7 or page 3 of 7.
Yes.
Which page are you referring to?
That is a little confusing. I apologize for that. I'm referring to page 2 of 7.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Which is also the very first page after the cover sheet for exhibit number 3.
Thank you.
If you look at the upper left-hand corner, milepost 665.70, that is the beginning of the 1.55 miles of common facilities that is utilized by the issue traffic and by the crossover traffic. If you and you see the red lines there, those are the linear yard tracks. If you turn to the second page of that exhibit, about three-quarters of the way down the length of that page, there's a faint milepost designation, milepost 664.15, if you can make that out. That is where the Intermountain plant spur separates from the main line, and then it curves away from the main line and heads off to the power plant. So as that exhibit and the UP's exhibit as well indicate, the tracks are very close together. In fact, the distance from the main line to the first yard track is 15 feet, which is about the distance from me to your desk there, your dais. The second track is about 15 feet beyond that. Now, the rail industry, as the board knows, is a network industry. It operates the system in the manner that is most efficient for the network. And in an area like this, where you have three tracks, those tracks will be utilized to handle the trains moving through the area in the manner that is the most efficient and achieves the best throughput given the number, the spacing, and the direction of the trains. The IRR is a standalone railroad designed to operate as a least cost, most efficient railroad, and it does operate in that fashion, utilizing all three of those tracks for the traffic that moves through there. The UP's second rationale for why crossover traffic does not share any facilities is that none of the crossover traffic moves over the main line. IPA's opening evidence, RTC model, shows that the northbound crossover traffic uses 1.55 miles of the main line. On its opening, IPA hardwired the RTC model to route all of the southbound crossover traffic through the Lindell Yard. It did that as a simplification measure. When UP said that this magically separated the traffic in a manner that there was no sharing of facilities, on rebuttal, IPA went back to its RTC model and allowed the system to use the main line for southbound crossover traffic if the main line was available. And in fact, when it was run that way, the traffic did use, southbound crossover traffic did use the main line as well as the sidetracks in the Lindell Yard. UP, in its RTC model, hardwired it so that all of the crossover traffic in both directions would move through the yard and none would move over the main line. Of course, that serves their argument that there's no sharing of facilities, but that is not the way the RTC model requires it. It did it that way only because it was told to. In summary, there is no Shipper 3 traffic because all of the crossover traffic moving between Lindell and Milford shares 1.55 miles of the core facilities and therefore qualifies as a Shipper 2 for purposes of the Otter Tail analysis. I'd like to turn briefly to address two other subjects. The first is a category of traffic that UP has excluded from the traffic group as defined by IPA. And these are premium intermodal trains referred to as Z-trains that move eastbound from LA to either Denver or Chicago. UP argues that these trains should be excluded from the traffic group because the transit time over the Milford to Lindell segment of the IRR is longer than UP's actual transit time in its operations. It charges that as a result, the IRR service would be, quote, significantly inferior to the service the UP provides. IPA has demonstrated in its rebuttal evidence that the additional time required for transit when IRR handles the traffic through that segment, approximately 30 minutes, is not consequential in any manner with regard to the Z-train traffic. And here's why. Number one, the Z-train traffic moves from LA approximately 1,400 miles to Denver and approximately 2,800 miles to Chicago. The shippers for that traffic are concerned about the arrival time of those trains at the destination. That's when they're able to get the containers off and to move them on as need be. When you look at the impact of this 30 minutes over that distance, when you compare the transit times for the entire movement from LA to Denver or from LA to Chicago, it is a truly minuscule number in terms of a percent of the impact on the total transit time. I can't say the numbers because they are confidential, but those percentages appear at page 21 of the In addition, the Z-train traffic spends a substantial period of time idle in UP yards awaiting further movement, And that time also provides a cushion in terms of any possible impact of that 30 minutes. And the evidence IPA presented also shows a significant interval of time for many containers between train arrivals and further handling of that container, which also provides a further cushion against any impact of that 30 minutes as far as the shipper itself is concerned. The other category of traffic that at this point I will stop and I will add any further comments with my rebuttal.
Mr. Molly?
I just want to ask you one question about the Z-trains. You admit that the Z-train traffic would take 30 minutes longer than it, because isn't the board's requirement that the service be at least equivalent, if not superior, and that's what we would have to do? If that is the case, should we resolve this issue in UP's favor? Because 30 minutes is 30 minutes. It is longer. It's not equivalent service.
In answer to that, I would say two things. First, let me be clear. 30 minutes is our number. They have some different numbers, mm-hmm. Some are lower than that, some are higher, depending upon what months you use. We compared the IRR's peak week to the UP's peak week. They say that's not right, but we think it is right. That's the apples-to-apples comparison. That's how we get our 30 minutes. As to whether the board precedent requires that because it takes 30 minutes longer, game over, the answer is no, the board precedent does not. It's been addressed in a number of cases. We discussed those precedents in our brief, each of them. You will find that what the board is really saying is, and it uses these precise words in some of the cases, that you have to demonstrate that you're going to meet the shipper's needs. The situations where the board has disallowed things that a complaining shipper tried to do with a standalone railroad are things like making all the trains a uniform length of 115 cars on the standalone railroad, when in fact many of the trains are 90 or 95 cars long on the railroad, and that was CSX. Three other cases also found the train length to be a problem. In another case, the standalone railroad set a limit of 115 cars per train, but yet the actual operations by UP, the railroad in that case, had a lot of trains that were longer than that. So the board would not accept 115. There were significant changes that impacted operations or contract requirements. And as the evidence we presented demonstrates, there is no significant impact in terms of the needs of the shipper, which, as I mentioned, relates to the movement from L.A. to Denver. We don't have another case like this in the precedents where you are looking at a time difference. In most of the standalone cost cases, it hasn't been an issue. Because it was clearly longer, even when you take into, or shorter, even when you take into consideration the interchange times.
Thank you.
If I could just kind of continue with Frank's question, which was a question I had as well. But so you're suggesting 30 minutes is a non-issue. What would be an issue? You know, at what point do you tip the scale too far? And I also like to know, how were you able to determine that it's the shipper's view that 30 minutes is a non-issue?
Well, our basic view on whether the shipper would see it as an issue has to do whether the shipper would even be aware of it. The evidence that we have presented indicates that the shipper would not, that it would be that the performance that the shipper encountered would not be affected by the differential in the time, because there are various other periods that occur in the chain of railroad handling of the containers before they get to the shipper that would more than absorb that 30 minutes. That's the point there. As to where do you draw the line, if not 30, you know, how much is it? I can't honestly say I have an answer for that, but it would clearly have to be, I would say, at least two or three times that before it could have an impact.
Following up on the consequential risk or significance of a number, does an overlap really exist between the IRR and UPN limbo? I mean, aren't you creating an overlap where one doesn't exist even under your own RTC modeling? Your argument says only two of 65 trains in a seven-day modeling period have any overlap at all. So why now? This is a tiny amount. You said the 30 minutes over the for the Z trains is a tiny amount. This is a tiny amount. So why is that amount not significant, and why is that tiny amount sufficient to avoid the cross-subsidy analysis that UP proposes?
Well, the board's conceptual framework for the cross-subsidy analysis is clear. You have core facilities. Those are the facilities that are utilized by the complaining shipper. If another shipper uses core facilities and other facilities, then it is shipper two. This traffic, when it is handled in the way an efficient railroad would handle it, would utilize all three tracks, the main line and the yard tracks, to handle the trains moving over this segment, regardless of where they're crossover or, the issue traffic will all move on the main line regardless because it peels off. But the you refer to only a few of the southbound, but all of the northbound crossover trains move over the main line at Lindell under the RTC model. So there is a significant amount of the crossover traffic that moves over the main line. In addition, we believe that it is a false distinction to claim that the track yards and the main line are not the same rail facility in the context of the board's analysis of cross subsidies.
Thank you.
One follow-up question. Let's say hypothetically, by your argument against UP's outer tail cross-subsidization argument. What if instead we went to the light density line and did a PPL cross-subsidy analysis and we exclude the 1.55 miles? Would the board be correct in looking at it that way as opposed to through the outer tail analysis that UP proposed?
Well, what I'm hesitating about is when you say eliminate the, clearly a PPL analysis could be done. We don't believe there is any PPL Montana cross-subsidy threshold, cross-subsidy concern. The UP would have the burden of showing same if there is under the board precedent, and we don't believe that they have. They have presented a template, if you will, which we have problems with, which we pointed out in our filings. But we believe that such an analysis would show that there's no threshold cross-subsidy concern with this system.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Council for Union Pacific. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you, and I plan to refer to some slides that I have. Good morning. Just to begin with, Jim, you have it exactly right that you can do a PPL cross-subsidy test. We did it, and the evidence is in the record. The issues that IPA had with it were some minor issues about how you allocate some particular types of costs, G&A-type costs, taxes. But the really critical point is that this Otter Tail case and the Shipper 3 was really a function of that case. There was this Shipper 3 and Otter Tail that didn't share any of the facilities with the issued traffic, and BN had argued to take out that traffic, and the board said, no, we're going to leave it in, and explained it. But the board realized that the situation presented an important point about taking the PPL Montana test to the next step. And I'm going to talk about that in more detail, but that next step applies to the PPL Montana test. It really has nothing to do with whether there's Shipper 3 traffic or whether there isn't. I mean, it's interesting the way they designed the SAR with this tiny overlap, if any overlap, to try to include all this traffic. And I'd like to talk about their design and how that was used to create a cross-subsidy. But whether there is an overlap or isn't an overlap really is irrelevant to applying this second step of Otter Tail. The theory, the economic theory behind it, works whether or not there is the Shipper 3 that doesn't share facilities. So I don't really want to make such a big deal of it, because the economic point is that if you're going to apply that PPL test and draw a line, you have to have this segment that's self-sustaining in a contestable world. That's what the second half of that Otter Tail test says. And again, it's where you draw the line for the PPL test. You can draw anywhere you want on the issue route. You don't have to include all of the core facilities. And you would apply the test in the same way whether there's whether there is or isn't a Shipper 3. It would apply to the Shipper 2. It would apply to the Shipper 2 traffic. So the overlap is interesting for the SAR design, but ultimately, it's not determinative of how you apply that second level cross-subsidy test. And I really do want to spend most of my time addressing the issue of that the board put in its oral argument notice, whether IPA's SAC model includes an improper cross-subsidy, and whether the board should apply the modified test that we proposed. Our proposal is a logical extension of the board's reliance on ATC to allocate crossover revenue when looking at cross-subsidies, and we think it would greatly simplify SAC cases by reducing the incentives that shippers have to extend their SARs in order to create cross-subsidies in their favor. And we think that would ultimately reduce the benefits on the parties and the board in these types of cases. But I want to begin briefly by talking about some of the revenue and cost evidence in this case. Because if you hold IPA to your established standards of proof, you're not going to need to address the other issues, because standalone revenues don't exceed standalone costs, and the case would end there. And this case should end there, because IPA's evidence substantially overstates SAR revenues and understates SAR costs. One of the issues was these Z trains, which IPA assumes the SAR is going to pick up at Milford, bridge over UP's bridge over its line and hand it back to UP at Lindell, and it assumes it's going to get this revenue even though it's not matching UP's transit times. Another, perhaps even more important example was when IPA started out its case by assuming that UP would pick up some traffic that was on the SAR and hand it over to IPA in exchange for this really tiny fee, where IPA then on rebuttal changed its method of operation. And there are a number of places where IPA also understates SAR costs, you know, through their accounts of locomotives, their fuel assumptions, the number of employees, their salaries. And IPA implicitly admitted many of these problems on rebuttal by submitting entirely new evidence in an attempt to address them. And the rules say that the board shouldn't consider this new material. The board's rules are designed to deter this kind of catch-me-if-you-can litigation. But even if you could consider it, you shouldn't. You know, IPA's tactics in putting in this evidence on rebuttal deprived UP of a fair opportunity to reply, but we discovered some serious problems even in the short time that we had to prepare our brief, and, you know, we could have addressed them in much more detail if IPA had followed the rules and submitted its evidence in its opening statement so that we could have addressed them on reply, including these Z-Train issues that Mr. Roth just spent some time on. And I'm happy to come back to these points and talk about the specific ones, but I do want to make sure I talk about the cross-subsidy issue. And the cross-subsidy issue flows from the way that IPA designed its SAR and selected its crossover traffic. And this case provides an unusually clear illustration of how shippers can undermine the SAC test by using crossover traffic to create cross-subsidies in their favor. So how did IPA create a cross-subsidy? Well, as you know, this is IPA's second challenge to UP's Provo to Lindell rates. In the first case, they challenged UP's rates from two origins east of Provo, the Skyline Mine and the Savage Coal Terminal. And in the first case, and I'm going to try to go to my slides now. In the first case, IPA replicated UP's route from Price to Provo, and then it went on from Provo to Lindell, and then it added the segment south of Lindell to Milford, even though its trains really, you know, don't move south of Lindell. Now, the first time around, IPA made a mistake in its ATC calculations. UP pointed out that IPA couldn't win once the mistake was corrected. And after some back and forth, IPA wound up dismissing that case and filing a new complaint. So what's the difference between the first case and the second one? This is really killing the drama. There we go. The only major difference is that IPA amputated the portion of its SAR from Price to Provo, which meant it had to drop its challenge to UP's rates from Skyline and Savage. So now IPA SAR replicates UP's route from Provo to Lindell. You have this long segment from Lindell to Milford, doubling the SAR even though the trains don't move over it. And, you know, this was curious to us because shippers complain that the SAC test is too expensive and too time-consuming, and then you have somebody bring a case, abandon two mines where they could possibly get relief, and then build a SAR twice as long as necessary. So why did they do this? There are two reasons. First, IPA recognized that the SAR's cost to build and operate the Price segment would be much greater than the SAR's revenue allocation for the segment. The Price segment was dragging the SAR down, and IPA didn't need to build the segment to still get some revenue credit when traffic that moved over that segment moved over the Provo to Lindell segment and the Provo and from Lindell to Milford. Second, because the SAR no longer included the Price segment, the extra contribution from this higher density Milford segment didn't have to be distributed over the Price segment. It could go back to the Provo to Lindell segment. And the reason that IPA built this Milford segment is basically the reverse of the reason for not building the Price segment. It's inexpensive to construct and operate relative to the revenue they're allocated. And this is what I was talking about when I said that shippers can undermine the SAC test through the SAR design and traffic selection process. The issue traffic in this case doesn't use either the price segment or the Milford segment, so IPA could choose whether or not to build them. And they chose not to. They chose to build a profitable Milford segment, even though the traffic really doesn't use it, and really most of the traffic on that doesn't share any facilities with their traffic, and they didn't build the price segment, even though actually most of the traffic on that segment does share facilities with their traffic. And you know, this was a choice. Shippers do the math before they settle on their SAR design. They figure this out. And absent some major miscalculation, a shipper is never going to build more than the core facilities unless there's some benefit to be gained from gaming the revenue allocation process. And usually railroads couldn't prove this. We'd have to go build a longer SAR to make our point, and there'd be all sorts of disputes about whether we'd done it or not. But in this case, there really can't be a dispute about what happened because IPA built the SAR in the first case. It tried to build a low-cost SAR, and it didn't have a winning case. So we can see what happens when you choose between building and using the revenue allocations. So now, in one sense, this is a crossover traffic problem, but in a very important sense, it's a cross-subsidy problem because what's happening here is IPA is using revenue from the Milford segment to subsidize reductions in its own rates. And the board's current internal cross-subsidy test isn't sensitive enough to fully address this issue, and that's why we proposed our new test. So to explain what we did, let me go back and look at the Milford segment. And basically, there are two types of traffic that are moving over the Milford segment. Some of the traffic, mostly coal, also moves over the Provo to Lindell segment, like the issue traffic. That's the light green. The other traffic, which is mostly intermodal traffic, never moves over the Provo to Lindell segment. IPA designed the SAR again to bridge this traffic between Milford and Lindell, and it hands the traffic back off to UP. And it was the second traffic that made us pause. So in our reply evidence, we showed how the board would apply the PPL Montana internal cross-subsidy test to see if IPA created a cross-subsidy that favored the issue traffic. And we illustrated this test using IPA's opening evidence. Our evidence said you shouldn't even get to this point because revenues don't exceed costs. So we used IPA's evidence. And we applied the internal cross-subsidy test to test the portion of the SAR from Provo to a point just north of Lindell, where on Mr. Loftus's map showed the lines, you know, just came together. And we did that so that we were cutting off any argument about whether this intermodal traffic was in or out. We picked a spot where it was out. And essentially, you performed the board's test by assigning all of the SAR revenue from any traffic that moves over the segment we were testing, that north segment, and determine whether those revenues exceed the traffic's attributable costs, which are the cost to build the Provo to that segment, and then the variable cost of operating south of it. If revenues don't exceed the attributable cost, there's plainly an impermissible cross-subsidy. It means that segment, which is a necessary part of the route for the issue traffic, isn't self-sustaining. It's not self-sustaining. And that's why the shipper lost in PPL Montana and Otter Tail. But even if revenues exceed costs, which they did in our illustration, there's an important second step that's also directed to detect and prevent cross-subsidies. And the board described this test in Otter Tail, where it said that the internal cross-subsidy test also establishes the limits on potential relief. So we calculated that limit on relief, and what you do is you apply the board's maximum markup methodology to the results of the first step of the PPL test, of the internal cross-subsidy test. And that produced the rates that you see in the third column here, which is from our reply evidence. And again, this is all based on IPA's opening evidence. By IPA's reply, they had agreed that the RVCs needed to be much higher, but we were using IPA's opening evidence because that's what we had at the time. And essentially, these ratios establish the limits on potential rate relief. And you can see those are higher than what IPA had calculated at the time was the maximum in all years, but I think 2013. And what that means, what this notion means, is that you can't take traffic from south of the line that we drew and use it to prescribe weights overall that are lower than these rate levels, or else it would be creating, it would also be creating a cross subsidy. Now why is that? It's because the board recognized in Otter Tail that if weights were set any lower after application of a whole SAC test to the entire SAR, and you came up with lower weights, then if you applied the internal cross subsidy test again to the north segment using those new weights, you'd fail the test. So in other words, the board would have been setting weights at a level that would have created a cross subsidy. And that was what the board, that was sort of the insight in Otter Tail, that you can't set weights so low after applying your own cross subsidy test to the whole SAR that you create a any portion of the SAR that's not self-sustaining in a contestable world. That was Otter Tail. And that has nothing to do with whether there is or isn't a Shipper 3. That's just applied to the results of the first step of the board's test. And in our illustration, again, application of the board's current test confirmed that IPA's SAC model had at least some impermissible cross-subsidy because the SAC test performed on the entire SAR produced rate levels below the limit on potential relief. But we looked at this and we thought, why does the current test assign all SAR revenues from any traffic that touches the segment north of the line to that segment? Isn't it likely that some of this revenue is really needed to support the fixed costs in other segments south of the line, or maybe someplace entirely off the SAR altogether? And the board's current test makes sense in light of its history. When the board adopted this test in PPL Montana, it didn't really have a revenue allocation method that it was confident in using to allocate revenues on a geographic basis. It was using a modified mileage prorate to allocate crossover revenues. But now the board uses ATC. And the board has said that ATC is the best method of allocating crossover revenues by geography short of performing a full SAC test. That's the whole purpose of ATC. And the board places tremendous confidence in ATC. It's used to allocate crossover revenue between on-SAR and off-SAR segments, and those allocations are hugely important in SAC cases. In every modern rate case, the revenues from crossover traffic dwarfs the revenues from issue traffic. If ATC isn't doing its job, then the results in all these SAC cases is meaningless. So why not use ATC when testing the SAR for internal cross subsidies? If it's good enough to allocate revenue between on-SAR and off-SAR segments to perform the SAC cross subsidy test, why isn't it good enough to allocate revenue within the SAR to perform the internal cross-subsidy test? The board has said that the internal cross-subsidy test is just as important, just as mandated by the guidelines. If a railroad isn't allowed to rely on cross-subsidies, neither is the shipper in challenging the rates. We think it has to be the case. If you're going to use ATC in one case, you have to use it in the other. You can't have separate sets of rules applying to cross-subsidies created by railroads and cross-subsidies created by shippers. And adopting our test would have, you know, pretty substantial benefits. If ATC is accurately allocating crossover revenues to prevent subsidization, then its use in the internal cross-subsidy test will make that test much more effective, much more accurate. Second, if you can more accurately identify these internal cross-subsidies, there'd be much less of an incentive to engage in what we saw here, the building of really extra SAR facilities in an attempt to take advantage of these types of internal cross subsidies. IPA had argued in their rebuttal that, you know, what we're really doing is restricting the SAR to replicating its own core facilities. We're sort of saying, you know, in future cases, you could never do more than build Provo to Lindell. That's not exactly right. There are advantages that the SAR still gains from building all the way down to Milford. There are the cost of interchange at Lindo that you'd have to take into account. They get those efficiencies. The SAR could still build from, you know, origin to destination to handle the issue traffic, but in most cases, the results under our test would probably be close to what you'd get if you confined a SAR to its core facilities. But we don't see anything wrong with that, and we don't think the board should either, because it already uses ATC to allocate revenues when testing for cross subsidies, and it's fair to both sides. The same rule applies when testing the railroad for cross subsidies and when testing the shipper SAR for cross subsidies. One more point. I just want a minute on equity flotation costs. The issue there is really very straightforward. These are just costs of raising equity. If you go out into the market and you need to raise equity, you need to pay Goldman Sachs or whoever you do it to raise the equity. It's just like when a SAR goes out, has to design the SAR, you've got to pay the engineer to do the design costs. Here, the IPA's capital structure assumed a certain amount of equity. We went out, we looked, and we said, because the board has said railroads haven't had enough evidence on what these costs are, we looked at a bunch of transactions of about the same time size in the same time period. We came up with what the fee is for raising equity, and we put it in there. And we think that's a cost that the board should clearly include. The same as designing a railroad. It's a cost that the SAR incurs to get up and running. And, you know, under the board's rules, we presented, you know, feasible, realistic evidence. IPA does nothing. They came up with some excuses about why our evidence wasn't good enough, but that's too late. Under the board's rules, if they don't address an issue like this on opening, and we present a feasible, realistic alternative, you know, under the board's rules, again, the board has to use our evidence. And we think it's accurate. We think it's accurate. This isn't a matter of game playing. This is something that's been excluded, I think, for too long from the costs of building a SAR.
Thank you. I know that we said to focus in this hearing on ATC and crossover traffic and the like, but I would like to turn back to another part of your a testimony or your evidence, which deals with some of the specifics, some of the cost drivers, which, while there was no numbers involved, if you would focus on some of the more important ones, and there I'm talking about wages, salaries, fringe, overhead, maintenance of way costs, et cetera, would you say that the purpose of the standalone cost test is to design a railroad that is efficient? And I think you're making the charge that they've gone over, that IPA went over that and went beyond efficiency and created, in some ways, a cost structure that was unrealistic. Do you want to comment on that and focus on what you think are the more important factors that were understated?
Sure. Well, I think that's right. I mean, we have a number of comparisons throughout the test, throughout our evidence, that show where in this, you know, particular case, they've gone, you know, by looking at some ratios, they've gone sort of far beyond what the board has accepted in other cases. I think one of the big examples here, actually, maybe they're related, the number of locomotives and the amount of fuel on the cost side. You know, essentially what they've done is they've said for the IPA issue traffic, you know, let's assume we have, you know, we need to put three, we disagree whether it's three or four trains, we think it's four, they think it's three. Let's say we have three trains, we've got to operate them 220 days of the year. You know, that's, you know, 0.6 of a year, so we need 0.6 times three trains, because it takes a, you know, 1 day round trip. You know, meanwhile, they're assuming that these locomotives are going to be ready to move their issue coal back and forth on call. They assume they're always going to have these locomotives, but they don't provide enough locomotives so that they're always available. So that's one big area where they've understated costs. They then try to look at the fuel for these locomotives, and they say, you know, we're going to operate them faster. We're going to operate our trains faster than UP operates their trains, and yet somehow we're going to burn, you know, we're going to burn less fuel. Those are a couple of the actually pretty sizable ones that matter. You know, again, there are a number of places where they assume that they can, you know, do maintenance using only two crews, you know, to or two teams to cover very long distances, longer than in prior cases. We've gone through a lot of them, but the troubling thing here is that this has been sort of a catch-me-if-you-can type of litigation. You know, there are places where we've come back and we said, look, you say you'll use one ratio. You're going to justify the fringes and benefits based on all of the railroads, you know, and it's 41%. And we come back and we say, well, actually, that's okay, but the real number is 44%. And then they come in and they say, oh, well, you know, well, if you just look at BN and KCS, it's 42%. There are a number of those, and that's okay. There's some back and forth, and I'm not meaning to be too critical, but I really urge the board to apply its evidentiary rules. They really are pretty clear, and they're meant to prevent this sort of thing.
But it's also true that the IRR would be using newer, more fuel efficient locomotives. And so you use the UP average, which would be an older set of locomotives. They would be using new ones. If a new startup company, one could assume that the railroads would have new locomotives, be more fuel efficient and perhaps more powerful as well.
Well, I don't know. I mean, they're trying. I guess there are two things. One, there's no evidence of that. They speculate in there that, well, maybe we'd be using more efficient locomotives. But the other point is, under their plan, you know, they're not just using their own locomotives, and this is part of this, how many locomotives they have. They're assuming they're going to get locomotives from other people. They're sending some locomotives offline, and other locomotives are coming online. So they're also going to get a mix of locomotives on their network. So they can't say that they're always going to have new stuff. And they tried this new SAR thing in some of these maintenance costs as well. They said, oh, we're going to have, you know, great track, you know, we only have to worry about, you know, a little bit of maintenance, a little bit of ditch digging, ditch clearing, whatever. But they had a witness who said, oh, you know, I worked on, again, on rebuttal, they put this guy in on rebuttal, that I worked on, you know, Werpy when it was formed, and we didn't really have high maintenance costs. But the costs here actually have to be over the 10-year SAR period. We're looking at the peak period. And one of the problems with looking at this, you know, this new railroad is that you can't just look on day one. You know, we're talking about its operations 10 years out when it's no longer quite so new. So, you know, that explanation doesn't quite cut it for those costs either.
Thank you.
A quick question, going back to the beginning of your argument with respect to your PPL analysis. How did that analysis play out versus your argument, otter tail type argument? I mean, what were the comparisons?
So, I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
As I understand it, in your analysis, IPA, based on your cross-subsidy analysis, IPA would lose. Is that right?
Well, no. Actually, no. I have to say that we were doing this test based on IPA's opening evidence. We were trying to illustrate this.
Okay.
Right? So it was, you know, for illustrative purposes only. We don't know how it would play out because a lot of this depends on things like what traffic ultimately is in the analysis at the end of the day.
Sure.
And what are the costs. So all that's going to matter. But what we showed was that if you apply just sort of the standard board's PPL analysis, that first step wouldn't have kicked the case out. IPA would not have lost. There was not a cross subsidy. But what we showed and what I was illustrating with that chart with the three columns, if you then, again, using just the standard, not using ATC, but the board's standard analysis with the otter tail insight that this test also has to serve on a limit of relief, then we showed that there would be a limit, and the limit would be higher than you'd get after running the full SAC test, which shows a cross-subsidy. It shows that you couldn't really sustain those lower SAC rates. Again, under that test, it doesn't mean they would lose.
Right.
It means that the maximum RVC would be higher, slightly higher than if you did the full SAC test. Now, again, even applying, using, we have another chart in there in our reply, which shows what would happen if you used our ATC version. And it's similar. IPA doesn't lose in our analysis. You don't get the result in PPL and in Otter Tail. They don't get kicked out. But when you apply the second test, again, the RVCs, the maximum RVCs are higher. So there's, you know, there's a cross subsidy. How all those RVC numbers play out after the traffic, I can't tell you. But in no case does it say that they absolutely lose in our examples. In our examples, there's still a rate reduction. It's just less than you'd get if you applied the SAC test without accounting for these cross subsidies.
Thank you. That does answer my question.
I have one other question if you. IPA says that your crossover traffic proposal is, in fact, a movement-specific adjustment which runs counter to the board's directives. Does your approach require a movement-specific adjustment to the IRR overhead traffic in a way that violates the spirit of the board's precedence on such adjustments? I mean, your approach does require modifying, for example, train lengths, empty car return ratios, and train type, et cetera, while the non-issue traffic is on the SAR, isn't that right?
Well, it's a slightly different issue. Our crossover proposal is just an application of the PPL test. We also had suggested some changes. You know, again, we think if the board is going to use ATC to test cross subsidies that the railroad creates, it ought to test cross subsidies the shipper creates. We think there are improvements that could be made to ATC, and we were, you know, frankly motivated by some of the board's suggestions in the APCO case about ways that you might modify ATC to reflect the characteristics of the movements,
mm-hmm.
You know, as they operate over the SAR, and we would be making changes to IRCs. You know, I don't think they're movement-specific IRCs. I think we're really modifying ATC. You know, ATC already breaks up the cost of the traffic into separate buckets. You're already departing from IRCs. You're taking out interchange costs and things like that. So I see it really as a modification to ATC and not really as a movement-specific cost.
Okay. So you're saying basically it's a cost allocation issue and it's not really a movement-specific adjustment?
I think it's an adjustment to ATC, which is already, you know, which is using IRCs, but I wouldn't really consider it a movement-specific adjustment. The other point is one of the things that has troubled the board in the past about movement-specific adjustments is that you're changing the cost allocation of a particular movement, and the way our methodology works, we're not changing the cost of any movement. We're reallocating the costs within the movement, so the totals still add up. You know, we haven't changed the cost of any one movement. We're shifting the cost to reflect the operations over the segment the SAR is replicating.
Oh, one more little general question. Don't the railroads really advocate? I mean, you speak of Union Pacific, but railroads in general advocate an outright ban on crossover traffic, that crossover traffic should not be included in the analysis. And if so, how does that square with the board's recent and historic precedent about crossover traffic?
Okay. You know, if I thought I could come up here and win with an argument for excluding crossover traffic, I'd make it. But, you know, we've gone through 715, we've talked about ATC, the board seems committed to using ATC. And now what we're saying is, you know, if you're going to use ATC to test for cross subsidies when it's, you know, the railroad that's accused of testing, of creating a cross subsidy, you ought to use it when you're testing for cross subsidies that the shippers are trying to create through their standalone railroads. So, you know, got to work within the board's rules. If you were willing to toss crossover traffic out, that would be great. We submitted evidence that showed the results of the case, if you're inclined to go that way, and you know that's in the record too. So you could go that way. We also submitted evidence that addressed the other board proposals in Ex Parte 715, the idea of only including unit train or train load traffic as crossover, or requiring them to originate or terminate the traffic. The evidence is in there if you're inclined to go that way. But if you're going to, you know, stick with the current formulation, at least for now, until we can convince you of otherwise, we've got an ATC-based test that we think is fair to both sides and an improvement over the board's current test.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenthal. I think you have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
I'd like to be clear about what's going on here with the UP's ATC proposal for cross-subsidy purposes. Standalone costs require grouping for captive shippers to have any hope whatsoever of sharing in the economies of scale, scope, and density available to the incumbent railroads. Crossover traffic in Otter Tail was described by the board as an indispensable part of standalone cost cases at this juncture, if shippers are going to have a chance at all to get any relief. Mr. Rosenthal makes it sound like, oh, happy day, you know, when the board developed its cross-subsidy analysis, it didn't have an ability to allocate revenues well, and that was a limitation on what it could do. But we now have ATC, so now you can do what the board really wanted to do all along. That's not true at all. What the board did in the cross-subsidy analysis is it said that Shipper 2 traffic that uses core facilities and also secondary facilities, that traffic, the contribution can all go to sharing the costs of the core facilities for the shipper. The what they're proposing now is that you take Shipper 2 traffic and instead of allowing all the contribution to go to the offset costs on the core facilities, that you divide the contribution between the core facilities and the secondary facilities. The board did not have anything like that on its mind in Otter Tail. If you look at page 10, and I'm going to read a quote, they're talking about the sharing of Shipper 3. You can have Shipper 3 because they can at least offset costs on the secondary facilities, even though they can't offset costs on the primary facilities. The board said, even if the revenue contribution from Shipper 3 were sufficient to cover the entire capital cost of the secondary facilities, then all of the revenue from Shipper 2 could be used to share the expenses of the core facilities. That would not entail a cross-subsidy. So the board wasn't thinking about, you know, trying to divide up the contribution from the Shipper 2 traffic between the core facilities and the non-core secondary facilities. The ATC system was devised for an entirely different purpose. It uses an entirely different universe of costs. ATC relies on the incumbent's system average costs. It relies on the incumbent's traffic densities in the real world. The cross-subsidy analysis, you look at PPL, and you look at Otter Tail, it relies on the SAC from the bottom-up costs, and it excludes the non-attributable costs. So it's a different universe of costs that are used for making the division. My time is short, and I want to hit a couple of other things quickly. We did not, in some underhanded fashion, design this system to create the overlap. The issue traffic moves over the UP main line down this 1.5 miles. There's no other way to get that issue traffic to where it's going without going over that segment. The first through change point on the UP after that is Milford. And there are a lot of good operational reasons for using that as the stopover point. I don't want to go beyond my time. Be happy to answer any questions.
No.
One question, since you requested that we hold the hearing, was there one particular aspect that you wanted to convey to us that you didn't feel was adequately conveyed in the record, or did you just kind of want to do the overview that you've been able to do so far?
Thank you for that question. There are a couple of things that I would like to mention very briefly. Sorry for taking so long. I'm trying to find the reference I was looking for. There are 2 points with regard to the UP local traffic that Mr. Rosenthal had mentioned in his remarks. And with regard to that traffic, there were 2 points that UP raised on its brief about IPA's evidence. It said that IPA had ignored the need to provide empty cars for the movement of the local traffic in its evidence, and that is not correct. And I would just simply direct the board to IPA rebuttal work paper local RTC trains.xlsx, which reveals that there were a number of empty cars sufficient to handle the loads delivered to each origin. UP also suggested that IPA failed to include all of the local trains that UP moves in the real world, and that is true, but the reason was that IPA did not put all of the local traffic that UP actually hauls on that segment onto its system, and IPA put on a number of trains adequate for the traffic it handled. It did use actual start times for the trains that the UP ran. There was, I don't think I made reference to the confidential work paper, that reveals one of the important elements of our explanation that the half-hour difference in transit time over the Milford to Lindell segment would not really have a meaningful impact on the shippers from the LA origin to the destination. That highly confidential exhibit shows the arrival time of the Z trains destination, whether they're within normal business hours or outside of normal business hours, and support the point we had made in that regard. Nothing further. Thank you.
All right. Well, let me make some friends. You know, each case that is presented on a rate case becomes more interesting, more complicated. It's not actually more complicated than the particular issue that we're talking about here. You know, and really, we've spent the last hour and 15 minutes talking about the hypothetical and arguing over what each side has tried to, you know, work within the board's rules, et cetera. But we've got shippers here. We've got a railroad here. And I hope that you will not resist the chance to keep talking and trying to resolve your differences in the real world.
Thank you. This is my last hearing. I just want to say it seems like over the last 9 years or so, these cases have gotten even more complicated over time. And we keep trying to simplify things, but every time we try and simplify things, it seems to add another level of complexity. So to some extent, I'd be happy not to be dealing with these anymore. But let me just echo what Ann says. I do hope that you can negotiate a settlement out of this, and something that's all parties can agree upon and make use of our processes. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much, counsel, for your time and excellent argument. Thanks, Frank, for your service. And this hearing is hereby adjourned. Thank you.